the most interesting guests in the music industry, entertainment, art, and politics, step into the studio for Turning Point with Frank McKay.
This week on Turning Point with Frank McKay, Richie Blackmore and his wife, Candace Knight, talk with Frank about the inspiration behind their Renaissance-style band, Blackmore's Night. While many people know Richie Blackmore as the legendary rock and roll guitarist from Deep Purple and Rainbow, for the past 15 years, he and Candace have been traveling the world performing a mix of Renaissance-inspired folk and rock music. Let's listen to this fascinating interview.
And now, Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Welcome to Turning Point, our very special guest today. Are Candace Knight and Richie Blackmore from Blackmore's Night. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you.
We were talking off-air of some of your earlier work. I think even though this is the 15th year, the anniversary of the 15th year that you started Blackmore's Night,
a lot of people... 15th beer there for me.
Yeah. I'm not sure a lot of people realize that you've been a band that long. That's a tremendous career for a band.
I know. It's unbelievable, isn't it? We started this project way back in 93, I think it was, and then we started recording it about in 96, 97. And it was just a labor of love. It was something that was a hobby of mine, listening to medieval Renaissance music. I first got exposed to it back in 1972, listening to David Monroe and the Early Music Consort of London playing the dances of Tilman Sassato. He was Flemish from when there weren't any borders up in Germany. And the music kind of stayed with me until now, because although I would play rock and roll in the old days, I was always going back to the hotel if we were on the road, and I'd be listening to medieval Renaissance music. And I used to get lots of complaints from the other band members if they could hear me through the walls saying, "What the hell are you playing in?" But it was I have a fixation on medieval Renaissance music. I just love the soul from those days. People say, "Oh, maybe you lived back in those times," and I probably did. And many people say, "Would you rather live back in those days?" And I say, "Not particularly, unless I had air conditioning and heating, then maybe."
Plumbing, sanitary conditions, that's nice.
Candace, how about you? When did your love for this type of music start?
I never heard of Renaissance music before I met Richie. So for all of the people who think that I was the one who twisted his arm and made him do this kind of music, completely untrue. Actually, when I first met him, and still to date, that's all he listens to. He has about 2,000 purist Renaissance and medieval CDs, or ethnic regional kind of folk music from strange areas, the Balkans, or places that we don't really hear much about as far as radio play these days in America. But he was the one who really introduced me to this kind of music, and I found it amazing because when I first met him, I borrowed some of his tapes. Back then they had tapes. I'm dating myself.
Yeah.
And I would just kind of walk through the woods I'm a very big nature person, so I put my headphones on and just go outside and watch the leaves fall or the snow fall. And listening to this type of music kind of wound up being almost a soundtrack to nature. It kind of all really fit. It was the audio that fit the visual and the imagery of what was around us and the beauty and the miracles in front of us every day, the sunsets and fireflies, and it was just so beautiful. So it kind of really completed that picture emotionally for me, and I became entranced with it, and I've fallen deeply in love with it ever since then.
Candace, you said it.
You've started drinking now, haven't you?
Candace, you said it.
Hang out with you and not drink.
That's right.
You said it almost as a joke, that people think that you turned Richie on to this type of music or changed him from rock to this. I know you were joking, but do you actually get that from Deep Purple fans or Rainbow fans?
We used to.
In the beginning, you did.
In the beginning, a lot of people said that, which is ironic because...
I used to just call her Yoko.
I was going to say Yoko. I didn't want to...
Yeah.
I know. Well, call that what it is, but have you ever seen John Lennon more happy than when he was with Yoko Ono, really?
No, absolutely not.
That's the funny thing, is that a lot of people, they have a mindset as to what their favorite band was, and it's nostalgic for them, and they always want those people to live in that bubble, and those bands to stay exactly the way they were in the 70s and never, ever change. And like anything, people change, people grow, they evolve, as musicians, as humans, their lives are constantly changing, kind of metamorphosis. I think it was the same thing with Richie. But what's interesting too is, his real diehard fans knew that this music was his passion. I mean, he would be on stage playing, hard rock music, but if he was going to jam on something, it would be on Greensleeve, or he would have 15th century or 14th century medieval modal scales, involved with a lot of the improvisational stuff or the solos that he did. That's actually how he wrote Smoke on the Water in 1971, with medieval modal scales that gave it that kind of dark, ominous sound. It wasn't just singular
parallel
notes.
Parallel fourths. Yeah.
Parallel fourths. Thank you, dear. So, which is pretty ironic, because when he wrote that in 1971 was the year I was born, so I don't really think I had much influence on him at that point.
Well, I was only three.
I can't be blamed. But it's always been within him, and listening to even the Rainbow songs, Temple of the King, 16th century Greensleeve. So anybody who really knew Richie for, his love of music knew that this was really deeply ingrained in his soul, and something that really kind of rang true with him emotionally as well as musically. So now we just enjoy it together.
I think even Stargazer, it certainly has that kind of influence.
That's right. Ronnie Dio used to be a trumpeter in an orchestra, believe it or not. And that's why he was very aware of how to sing in a classical mode. So that kind of enticed me to be involved with him too, because I love the way he approached songs from a classical point of view, not just improvising and shouting.
We're going to go to break right now, and when we come back, we'll have more.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Did you ever see Elf live?
What was that?
The band Elf. That was his.
Yeah,
that was
they
his
used band. To. They used to support when Purple did a show. We often used to have Elf on supporting us, and at that point, I knew that Ronnie was very talented. The whole band was a great band, and it was very interesting how every one of them was under, I think, 4'11".
Wow. Is that true?
They were like four small guys,
Yeah, that's funny.
And they looked the part, so it was very interesting. And there's this big voice came out from this little guy.
I mean, he certainly influenced a lot of rock, and you had certainly been his influence. You found a star there, and you really, the two of you together, changed certainly the next generation of rock and metal and so forth. I mean, did you ever think, looking at him in Elf, that this is, this is somebody who can transcend some styles?
When I first met him, he was singing, how it started with Ronnie was, I wanted to do a song called Black Sheep of the Family, very appropriate, and Purple didn't want to do any cover songs. So I said, Ronnie was on tour with me. Huey McDowell was on tour too, from ELO. And I said to them, let's go in the studio and let's do this song, because I really like the song. So we did that, and Huey McDowell was on cello and drinking. And we ended up, that was the first tune I ever did with Ronnie Dio, was Black Sheep of the Family. And it turned out really well, and I was so pleased with it. I said to Ronnie, let's do some more songs when we've got some free time. And that's when we did our first record as Rainbow. And we didn't know what to call the band. And we both used to go to the Rainbow Bar and Grill in Hollywood. So we're sitting there drinking. And we thought, let's call it Rainbow. And that's how we kind of started that whole thing. But it was interesting how Ronnie used to have a fear of whenever he would wake up, he never knew if he had a voice. He would say to me, it's all right for you. You know you can play when you wake up, but whereas he had a big fear of losing his voice. So I think a lot of singers have that fear. They don't know they can sing until they actually sing, which I've never thought about before.
Was Coverdale like that?
Coverdale was, the way that we found him was Ian Pace played me a tape, a cassette. We were going through all these cassettes looking for a new singer. And he played that, and I said, wow, that guy sounds really good. Who is he? And he said, well, he's some guy from up north of England, Yorkshire, working in a boutique. And I said, oh, let's get him down and try him out. And basically, that's how we found him. We tried him out, and he fitted in well. And that's how he started. In fact, I spoke to Dave about 5 days ago. He lives out in Lake Tahoe.
This is probably a hard question because, of course, you're married, but who does Candace remind you of that you've worked with in the past? Is it unique because of your marriage, or does she remind you of working with, you know, Coverdale or Gillan or Dio?
Yeah, she reminds me of David Coverdale because she's always shouting at me and calling me baby.
That's funny.
What about writing style, the two of you collaborating? Who does it feel most like?
I usually sit down, you know, I'm playing an idea or a riff or a melody, and when Candy's kind of doing the hoovering and scrubbing floors, I say, can you just whistle or hum this song a minute? I want to see if there's potential. And we take it from there, and I can always tell if it's going to go anywhere. And invariably it does, because she's got a unique way of picking up melodies instantly, much better than me. We'll take it from there. And of course, she always does the lyrics and the singing. So it's a great relationship in that respect, because I used to find being in the confines of the band side of things, when I was even in Rainbow Purple or whatever, we'd have rehearsal days, and sometimes you wouldn't feel like playing. And if I had an idea, nobody was around to pick up on the idea, although I could record it, but it wasn't the same as just sitting down with a guitar and someone's already there in the house, and you can just play these ideas. To me, that was a much more natural way of progression of writing than being in a rehearsal mode and playing and doing things that way. So that comes in handy, being around each other so you can bounce ideas off of each other.
Candace mentioned Smoke on the Water earlier, the riff in Smoke on the Water. Did you ever imagine, and I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, did you ever imagine that this would be the anthem that it became, and certainly the staple in a young guitarist's repertoire that it has become?
Well, at the time, I did it out of being irritated by the musical stores in the area. I thought, I want to write something that everybody's going to pick up on and play in the music stores, and so that the so the people running the shop would scream.
And we don't play it anymore.
That's right. Yeah. I've been in shops where they say, please do not play the Smoke on the Water riff.
I've seen it posted.
Yes. And I've seen it in Butchers. I've seen it in King Cullen.
That's amazing.
I've seen it all over the place. Sawn of Arth. When I first did that, we were recording in Switzerland, Machine Head, and we had this fantastic ballroom that they'd given us to record in. And that Pacey and I, usually Ian Pace, I would say to Ian, what's a good rhythm to play? And he would start playing a rhythm. And he started playing that 8 to the bar type of rhythm. And I just joined in with that riff. And it was just the two of us that kind of put that down at first. And then the others joined in, and it started from there. And it's strange how that particular place, when we recorded Smoke on the Water, the police were hammering on the door to tell us to shut up, and they were going to close the place down because we were making too much noise, and all the residents were complaining within the area that we were too loud. So it was no thanks to the police of Montreux that we finished the song. We knew it was the police at the door hammering, but we just had to do a final take. Then we had it. We did the final take, and they were hammering on the mobile door, which is a mobile unit, Rolling Stones mobile. And then we let them in, and they said, oh, you've got to stop, you've got to get out of here. We knew that was coming. So we only did that one song at that ballroom, that place. The rest of the songs we did in a hotel, hallway, actually. So I always remember it was so funny that we had to keep the police out of the recording studio because we knew they were going to tell us to stop. And we couldn't stop because we had final take.
Did Frank Zappa ever mention the reference to you personally? Did you ever talk about it?
Yes, he used to mention it a few times. And obviously, we went to see Frank Zappa at the time. And he was in concert. And like it says in the song, someone did have a flare gun. They shot from the audience up into the roof. And it caught the roof alight, and the place, it was very interesting because Frank came to the microphone and said, okay, everybody, don't panic. We're going to have to exit in a very civilized manner, of which he threw his guitar down and jumped basically out of the window, which was on ground level, because he wanted to be first out, which was a very funny thought, the way he told everybody to be very civilized in leaving the establishment.
Are there any
to the ground? It was very, very dangerous because within 15, 20 minutes, the place was burnt to the ground. And there was a coat stand that got caught on the exit, and nobody could get out of the building because everybody was pushing. You've got 2,000 people pushing out of one exit, and we couldn't get out. And it was crazy. So just goes to show, when there's a fire, it's you have to have a lot of exits.
Are there any recordings out there that, and I thought of this when I mentioned Frank Zappa because he was legendary for these impromptu improvs in his basement. Are there any Ritchie Blackmore recordings out there, collaborations that you wish you could have, or you wish would come out just over the years?
Well, not that I know of. I tend to just kind of look forward. I don't look back very much, you know. Not that I know of. I mean, I know that it was funny. The other day, some fan came up to me and said, oh, I heard your new solo on Smoke on the Water. And I said, what do you mean, new solo? And they said, well, I don't particularly like the new solo on the record. And I had no idea that Roger Glover had been in the studio and changed some of the notes around from my rejected solos. So needless to say, I'm not happy about that.
We're going to go to break right now, and when we come back, we'll have more.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this.
Welcome back to Turning Point. Our special guest, Candace Knight and Ritchie Blackmore. Are you friendly with Glover?
Not anymore.
Oh, okay. How about the other guys? You're friendly with Glenn Hughes, I know, right?
Oh, yeah. All the guys. You know, I just don't respect it when someone goes in the studio and changes notes around that have been rejected, you know. It's a bit odd. But, yes, I talked to all the other guys. And and it was a sad thing about John Lord passing, of course, because he was one of my favorites.
Oh.
We always used to go out to dinner together.
Where did he live in his last years?
He was lived in England.
Yeah, he never lived here, right?
He did for about 6 months when he was on a tax exchange thing. He lived out in Malibu. And when we all came here, because the reason Purple all came here is because our taxes in England went up to 82%. And nobody was willing to stay in England to pay that. So we all came across to America. And I kind of stayed, and they all went back.
Yeah, right. That's 82%. That's amazing when you say that. That's almost unreal, unbelievable.
Yeah. Yes, as Candy was just saying, speaking of America, we do have a tour coming up.
Yeah.
I wish Candy to fill you in on the dates.
Where will it start?
Where will it start?
I believe it's in Tarrytown, New York, upstate.
Right.
Right on the border of Sleepy Hollow.
Where we got married.
And right, yes, right where we got married, exactly. They say there's some kind of energy vortex up there, which I think we contributed to.
Yes.
Ultimately. But
it's a wonderful castle.
And but it's going to be right around Halloween time, so that's the perfect time to go around the Sleepy Hollow area.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you go from there? Are you doing the whole country, Candace?
No, Richie doesn't like to travel that much, so... right now, he's at the point where he's not crazy about flying domestically either, so we're going to go to just a few places we can drive to and then come back home. I think we're going to Tarrytown, New York, then we've got one in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, and one in Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're only doing 4 dates. It's very select this time, and then we head back into the studio. So our last date is going to be in New York City on November 2nd at the theater, the Ethical Culture Theater, Society of Ethical Culture.
Over 15 years of doing this, you must see a lot of the same folks, and I'm sure being in close proximity, some of them, I'm not comparing you to the Grateful Dead, but I'm sure there's certain people that you have a bit of a cult following with this style
actually,
of music.
Richie often says that the first couple of rows are all the same people, and he's wondering if anybody else even comes to the show. You have to see the same familiar faces after years and years. But it can be compared to the Grateful Dead because it's such a community. It's really interesting to see. A lot of the people, when they find out when we do our tour dates, and then they take vacations from wherever they are in the world. So we've had Australian fans, Japanese fans, they fly into when we're playing in Germany. The German fans fly into England. So people are flying in all over the place, and they meet up with other people at the shows and become friends for a lifetime. So it winds up being like a big reunion. And they all go to each other's houses and sleep on couches and floors and things and then travel on to the next shows. So it's a really beautiful kind of community.
I wonder if they actually come to see us or just get together on their own.
With their friends. That's possible.
You know, our standard question is, and the name of our show, of course, is Turning Point. What was the turning point in your career or what was the turning point in your life? But let's put it this way. What was the turning point in Blackmore's Night?
I think it was when I fell off stage. I kind of hit my head, and I thought, I must play medieval music the rest of my life.
I think the turning point for you was, I know exactly the turning point, actually. There was a very clear fork in the road for Richie in 1995 or 6, I think.
Actually, it was, yes, okay.
He had already handed in his resignation notice with Deep Purple. He went and reformed Rainbow, but he wasn't crazy about the way that was going, or the rock and roll world was going. It became very corporate at that point.
Generic,
he says. And so he could have gone in one of two directions. He could have stayed with Rainbow and continued on in the rock world, or he could have gone ahead with Blackmore's Night. When we were in Massachusetts, he was recording with Rainbow at that point. In 95, and while the other guys were doing their tracks for the Stranger in Us All CD, Richie and I would be sitting by a fireplace playing acoustic music, looking out the window with the snow falling, and on a farmhouse, and it was beautiful. And so our music wound up being his escape from the rock and roll world, or what it had become, which was mainly egos and people in corporate offices telling them what direction the music should go into and what they should wear and what the title should be. So it wasn't much artistic creativity. And, of course, Richie's all about artistic creativity. So we were writing our own music and doing it just for ourselves. We never thought we would put a CD out there or any music out there until our friends heard our music and thought, they told us that if we put CDs out that they would actually buy it because they enjoyed what we were doing so much. But Richie continued on the road. He went to a Sweden rock festival where they were headlining with Rainbow. And when he was on the way there, something interesting happened. Richie, do you want to finish the story?
No, I think you're in over your head.
Am I? Okay, well, I'll just put it out there, whatever. But what wound up happening was right before he was going to leave to go on that tour or to do those few dates, the festival dates, he got a phone call from a couple of the band members who apparently were staging a mutiny. They said, if you don't pay us double the money, we're not coming on tour. And it was a few days before the shows. So Richie called the promoters and said, can I pull out? And they said, no, all the advertising's been done. You need to show up or you're going to be sued. He was in a horrible situation that some of his band members had put him in. It was really terrible.
But it wasn't the drummer and it wasn't the the keyboard player.
Yeah, you narrow it down. That's yeah. Yeah, it wasn't them, right? Exactly. That narrows it down a little bit.
It was the other two.
Yeah.
So, you know, we basically went through, we promised the guys their demands, what they had demanded, and got over there, and Richie, at that point, was so angry and had to be on stage with these people who had basically blackmailed him to do this date. And after he stepped off stage, he wrote a contract. The American agent was there. He said, look, we have a year's worth of touring for you all throughout Eastern Europe, all throughout America. If you want to continue on with Rainbow, let's do it. Richie said, I can't with this band doing what they just did to me. I'm going to write a contract, one-page simple contract that basically says, this is what you're contracted for. If you want to go on the road and continue on with Rainbow, sign on the X, give it back to me before you get on the plane, and we'll move ahead. If not, I'm going to move ahead with other things. And that's exactly what happened. He handed the contract out. Two of the guys gave the contract back, signed immediately. Two of the guys went out, got drunk, got on the plane, and didn't hand the contract in at all. About a week later, they called up and said, what's going on with the tour dates?
Oh, my God.
That was the turning point. Richie, at that point, said, I'm moving ahead with Blackmore's Night. That wound up turning. That was when, in 1997, we went into the studio. We finished recording the songs that we had just written spur of the moment while he was, you know, doing the other stuff with in that farmhouse. And it was 15 years. It's been 15 years now. So that was an absolute definite. You can't get more of a fork of the road in the road than that, really. You know, it's one way or the other.
That's an inside story.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But that's the truth of what happened. Right. And that's how Blackmore's Night wound up being formed. And years later, we're still continuing on our journey. And it's probably the best thing that could have happened.
Because
I've never seen him happier on stage. He's actually not in a box where he only plays one genre of music. He gets to play whatever he wants to, whenever he wants to. He does extended solos and intros. You'll never hear the same song twice. He changes the set list every night. We have great band members who are just amazing people as well as amazing musicians, very versatile and funny, and everybody gets along like we're at summer camp whenever we go on the road. And I think, you know, positivity-wise, he's just in a much better place. And you actually do get to see Richie Blackmore on stage smiling now, which is before you never would have seen that.
We've never seen that before.
You know, exactly.
I try not to, and I hide my face if I'm about to smile. So it's not too many people.
At this point, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll do our final few minutes.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
You know, I wonder how many artists out there, how many musicians, and especially you know, people at your stature, are looking at you and saying, you know, this is what I should be doing, rather than trying to fit into a corporate mold and to try to appease everyone that's out there, my fans and so forth. Why don't I do something I love? And I can't believe more of them that can afford to do it.
You get caught up in the machine, you know. When I was in Purple, you know, it was never-ending touring, never-ending in the studio, because there was lots of money to be made for management, agencies, and promoters. Meanwhile, we're worked to death. And then you become overtired because you're playing in Brazil, to Japan, to wherever. And I couldn't even keep up with the pace of it all. I just got fed up with you know, being at an airport, going somewhere else. And then you find at the end of the day, the money side of it is not that great compared to what the people are earning by picking up a phone and saying, oh yes, Deep Purple will be there.
Right.
So I think a lot of bands, I should imagine a lot of guys in big bands are probably fed up with being in that big band, and they want to jump ship. But there's so much pressure. You know, you've got people saying, no, you can't do that. You're letting the band down, and we need you, and you've got a contract. You have to play, blah, blah, blah. So that's it got to the point where I remember I was in Italy, and one of my roadies came to the door, and I opened the door, and he said, oh, these are contracts that you should sign before you go on stage tonight. And there must have been about 1,000 pages. And I said, I'm not signing this. This is ridiculous. And that's when I put my foot down and when I left a couple of weeks later. But it was a big moment. You had this whole force on the other side saying, you have to sign, you have to do this. And it's amazing how you become taken over by the monster. So one has to turn around, put your foot down, and say, "Nope, I'm not doing it anymore." And the way that we're structured now is, I get to see the itinerary of where we're playing, and I kind of route it, and I can take as many days off as I want. It drives the agency a little bit crazy, but because I like lots of days off if we're traveling. So, but I have complete control over where we play and how we play.
How about your recording process? Is it, I imagine it's completely in your control, but are you recording out of the house? Do you use local studios? Do you use studios on the West Coast? What do you...
Yeah.
Well, you know, when we first moved into our home here, it's kind of a contemporary home, but it's got a great stone fireplace, and we made it a point to say, we'll get this house, but only if we can convert it into a medieval dwelling.
Right.
So we went to work at putting up sconces and tapestries and making everything very dark colors, and Richie said he wanted to be the only musician who didn't have a studio in his house. He wanted his barroom dungeon. So we have that stone-walled dungeon downstairs. It's a bar with medieval torture devices hanging on the walls. So we're well protected here in our fortress. And about maybe 8 years ago, he finally succumbed to saying, you know, it would be better if we have, off of the dungeon room, a little studio in here so we can basically just roll out of bed and go down into the studio when our producer comes in. We fly a producer in from L.A., and he moves into one of the rooms in our home.
Pat Reagan,
yeah. Right. And so we're able to just go downstairs into the studio when we're ready to record when he's here. And we book him for a couple of months at a time. And
I think what prompted that was not wanting to leave our cats.
That's true.
We have two spoiled cats.
And no dogs, just cats?
And it was finding people to look after them that we trusted,
right,
for the amount of time we would have been away if we'd have gone to a studio.
So now we record in the home, and he has a mobile unit that he brings out, and we have a little area there that's got, you know, that's really well sound, you know, soundproof.
Yeah.
And we do everything out of the house, and we've been doing that for years now.
Yeah,
a long time.
I like it that way.
I don't know if you have a running.
Now I'm one of those musicians that has a studio in the house, so I'm just like everybody else.
Yeah, no, I don't think you're like everyone else. Maybe
no,
maybe
you
in
still
that
have
respect.
Your dungeon, so.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you have a running tally, but do you have an estimate of how many songs you've actually recorded in these 15 years?
No, you know, it's an awful lot. I would say 60-odd or something.
It's got to be more than that. We do like 16 tracks a CD, and we've got, what, like 10 CDs out?
I never listen to my own music, hardly ever, unless I'm down the road in one of my favorite restaurants. They have a jukebox, and they have it on the jukebox. Then I hear it, and it's kind of... It's refreshing to hear it because then I haven't heard it for so long.
That's true. You don't listen to your music.
Once he gets it out, it's out there. He doesn't even have any of the old CDs or anything from the earlier bands. And even with our stuff, once he gets it out creative-wise, once it's out there, he's on to the next thing. So.
I think I have one Purple record. I don't know where that is. I think it's downstairs somewhere.
I'm curious to know which one it is, if you only have one of Machine Head.
It was probably something that someone gave me, you know, and... My favorites in those days were Machine Head and Deep Purple and Rock and Burn. But I don't have them. I have, you know, the gold records and all that, and that's very nice to have. You know, but what's that?
What was your favorite Rainbow record?
Favorite Rainbow record was, well, the first one was great because it was exciting and new. And I think from the songs, like Stargazer, I liked... That worked out well, and Gates of Babylon worked out very well. That's where our heads were at, although we wrote other songs that I didn't think were so good. But those two songs kind of stuck out, I think.
You know, I always wanted to ask you, one of my favorite albums was your live Rainbow album on stage, and you didn't put Stargazer on that album.
It was amazing that every time we rehearsed Stargazer, it did not work. And to this day, I don't quite understand why. Every time we'd rehearse it, because we all liked the song, it just sounded flat. And so consequently, we didn't do it on stage. It was weird. And we had the same problem with Gates of Babylon. That did not sound right. it was like a studio effect. It was weird.
Anyway, is there anything you'd like to add? I appreciate your time, the both of you.
Wow.
Thank you. Let's see, just that the new DVD-CD combo, A Night in New York, is out probably right now. It's just released. We recorded it over in England in
a haunted theater.
A haunted theater. Oh, it was a haunted opera house. And the reason was because we had two other live DVDs out. One of them, we originally recorded one of them in a medieval castle in 2004 called Castles and Dreams, and the next one was 2007. We did Paris Moon in a theater in Paris, and then we realized that it's been about 2 years since the last live album was out there. So at that point, we had all these new songs that we had put out on Autumn Sky and Secret Voyage on those CDs. So a lot of them, when we play them in concert, they have a whole different arrangement and different energy to them because of the live environment. So a lot of fans wanted to know when we'd be putting out the next DVD that would showcase the new songs that we had done the last few years. And so we thought the best place to do that would be in a haunted opera house in the medieval city of York, England. So that's where we recorded it.
York actually was the capital of England before London.
That's true.
It goes way back. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it is. And so that's
I
that
just made
now.
That up. No, I didn't.
No, that's true. That's...
Hey, how would you know?
In Frank's validity.
I know my history.
Okay.
But I will Google it to make sure before we edit it.
Okay.
Good call.
One last thing. Is there a website that you'd like to point people to?
Sure. Of course. Blackmoresnight.com. So it's all one word, Blackmore's Night. That's night like in nighttime, not K, night. So we have a Blackmore's Night, also CandiceKnight.com. Usually right up to the minute. Updates on those too, and of course we have our Facebook and Twitter pages.
We have a Facebook. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you do. I try to keep you out of it, so
okay.
You don't get annoyed with things.
You're not a Facebook guy, Richie.
No, I'm.
Richie doesn't even have a cell phone.
No.
That's not true, is that?
It is true. He sends everything by carrier pigeon.
Oh yeah. My gosh.
Or smoke signal.
I'm just too old for all that.
He has a cell phone. He keeps it plugged in the car, but he can't figure out how to use it, so it's pretty useless actually.
Well, it's good to know. It's hard to reach you, so nobody could bother you with silly things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He does surf the web, though, when he wants more medieval inspiration. He does know how to go onto YouTube and type in medieval bands. So.
I learned that.
Every once in a while, I catch him surfing on there.
But if I go out, for instance, and Candy is going to call me, I tell her to call whoever I'm out with,
mm-hmm.
because obviously they have their cell phones.
Is there a favorite medieval band that you have out there, Richie?
There are so many, and most of them are pretty unknown. The top of my head, I have one of my mentors was a band called Die Geierschwarzhaufen, and that's a German band. And another band is a Czech band called Gothian.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that's into medieval music, kind of crossover style, Gothian always tour with us, and so does... the Geiers. They're called the Geiers now, Des Geiers, which is German. And they taught me a lot about how to use nickel harps, how to use hurdy-gurdies within the framework of what we're doing. So now I'm playing hurdy-gurdies and nickel harps and mandolas, which are incredibly exciting to play because they're so organic. And but that's my world.
You know. Our special guests today have been Candice Knight and Richie Blackmore from Blackmore's Night, and the new album is coming out, and new DVD is coming out, and the tour is starting. Pleasure to have both of you. Thank you very much for your time.
It was a pleasure. I mean, pleasure.
Okay.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week on Turning Point.
Turning Point with Frank McKay was produced by Out of the Box Studios in Bohemia, New York. Executive producers, Frank McKay, Harry Oates, and Bart Pellegrino. Director of Operations, Corey Arnold. Segment producer and talent coordinator, Kristen McKay. Audio and studio engineers, Francis Kesmarek and Tom Shazam. Studio support, Mark Harwood, Pete Galgano, Brian Hunt, Danielle Altobrando, Keith Withers, and Chris Loom. Sound mixing and mastering, Daniel Joseph. Hotel accommodations provided by Ohika Castle Hotel and Estate in Huntington, New York. Transportation services provided by Markham Elegance Limousine in Hop Hop, New York. Catering services provided by Windows on the Lake in Ronkonkoma, New York.